day is Townsell against Dish Network. Mr. Keough.
Thank you. Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. Keith Keough on behalf of Appellant Jacqueline Townsell. The District Court in this case denied Ms. Townsell's motion to leave the file amended complaint, which sought to replace her claim under the Electronic Fund Transfer Act with a claim arising under Section 407A of the Social Security Act, as well as two state law claims that were dependent upon that claim. In doing so, the District Court declined to decide whether there's an implied prior right of action under Section 407A, but instead held as a matter of law that Ms. Townsell cannot state a claim under the Act because she did not transfer complete control of future benefits or all her transfer benefits. As an initial matter, there's no requirement that an assignment must transfer all control or all rights to future benefits, which is what this Court held in Tidwell. Further, Dish Network doesn't contest this fact and has put forth no argument at all to support the trial court's conclusion.
Tell me, what's the assignment here?
The assignment is the contract that Ms. Townsell signed that provided her debit account information, which allowed Dish Network to, at some point in the future, if one of the parties or canceled the contract, to charge her a cancellation fee within 24 months at a certain rate and a predetermined calculation. So,
but the contract, I don't see what's an assignment of anything.
Well, Your Honor, it's Section 407A deals with an assignment or transfer in law or equity. So it's much broader than just a technical legal issue. Now, Dish Network focuses its argument.
How broad is it? That's the issue, I guess.
Well, I think, Your Honor, as this Court held in Tidwell and Mason, that the it's fairly broad and sweeping, that the intent of 407A is to protect funds of beneficiaries from creditors, which is what we have here. We have Ms. Townsell, who's a beneficiary, and Dish Network is nothing but a creditor. Unlike the cases they cite, they are not a state agency providing aid or maintenance for her. They make it a point of saying that TV is not a necessity, so they are not seeking reimbursement of funds to recoup for maintenance. Now, I think it's important to note that in Tidwell, there was two ways which an estate can take the funds. One was where the person signed over a voluntary consent and the fund was put in a trust bank account on behalf of the beneficiary. Then the state took the money from that. There was a second way, though, and I think the second way is probably more analogous to this case. If the person was incompetent, a special payee was appointed, which could have been a family member, or if none existed, the administrator of the state plan. If it was a family member or either one, funds were deposited from or given to that special payee family member and then deposited in a trust bank account and then taken by the state. So in Tidwell, the state did not receive the money directly, at least under one of the schemes. And this Court found that to be an assignment. So, and we think that the Dish's reliance upon the fact that they don't receive the funds directly is irrelevant.
There are a whole bunch of cases that deal with efforts by states to offset their benefits by the amount of retroactively collected Social Security benefits. That's what leads to things like Philpott. Is there any reason to think that Dish was trying to collect Social Security benefits? It was just trying to get paid for its services. If any of these cases dealt with the use of the deposit of Social Security benefits in a checking account that's then used to pay for normal commercial goods and services? Any of them?
Not to deal with assignments, the ones that deal with legal process. For example, there's currently a Treasury rule that requires banks, if they receive garnishment orders, to check to see if those funds are protected by the Social Security Act. So
do you think such orders ought to be issued to landlords, public utilities, grocery stores, TV suppliers, so they all have to check before they impose, to check on the sources of the funds in the account?
Well, Your Honor, I think that gets into the whether they're revocable or not. There's a variety of different ways of whether you can ensure that companies like, you know, who are creditors don't violate the act, and asking the bank or having on a contract that...
So you're saying that this provision should be unlawful under any circumstances?
No, Your Honor. I think all the cases hold that the intent of 407A is to protect these funds from creditors. And Tidwell makes a distinction between the cases that allow it by saying that in Tidwell it's more than a mere obligation to pay, that if a person did not choose to pay, those funds would be protected. Well, in this case, Ms. Tonsil did not choose to pay.
All
the funds were taken.
Why couldn't she simply move, just ask Social Security, for example, as defense suggests, to have her Social Security checks deposited in a different bank account?
Well, Your
Honor.
Set
up a new one.
And Tidwell dealt with this as well. I mean, granted, she could have moved her funds. She could have hidden her funds. She did not intend to enter agreement and then hide funds.
It's not a question of hiding. It's a question of segregation. You could have one account for your funds and one account that you use to promise to pay creditors. My question is related. If you prevail in this case, what do you expect to happen? One thing that might happen is that the Dish Networks of the world would simply refuse to deal with anybody who's receiving Social Security benefits because they couldn't promise to pay. And this arrangement, like, say, getting a cell phone, you pay for the equipment through the cost. It's amortized over the monthly service charge with a termination fee if you quit early. The other thing Dish could do is say, do you receive Social Security benefits? Check yes, no. If yes, Dish would then say, you must prepay for your first 2 years of service. Right? Prepay the whole thing. Now, how could that possibly help Social Security recipients?
Your Honor, I don't think that Dish would be allowed to charge a higher rate for certain segments than others. I think that, as we put in our brief, if they just put in their contract that this consent to debit this account is revocable if you are Social Security benefits or receive Social Security beneficiary.
You're not dealing with my question, right? I asked you how the things businesses would do. If you win, businesses will do, it seems to me, two possible things. One is they'll just stop dealing with people like your client. The other, more plausible, they'll require any recipient of Social Security benefits to prepay the whole thing. My question is, how would that help Social Security benefits? Presumably this statute is designed to help them, not to imprison them in their privileges in a way that they can't engage in commercial transactions on the same terms as normal people.
Your Honor, I think there's a third option, which is they'll continue to do business with these people as they are now. Just because if they can't sue them for the funds, I mean, people switch bank accounts. Just because there's an act protecting the money does not mean that businesses will not do business with them. There's a benefit of the bargain.
Well, I will agree. There is a third possibility. They'll say, when I know somebody is on Social Security, that's an extra business risk, so I'll just charge more. But that would just come back to the same point as before. How would that help Social Security recipients if they paid 10% more for Dish service than younger people?
Or it's already built into profit margins, and therefore they don't need to charge more.
No, that's not very likely.
Well, I guess the issue is we don't know that, Your Honor, and I think
yes, we do. In competition, people charge as much as they can. Dish Network doesn't charge more because it faces competition from DirecTV and cable. But it doesn't charge less. It's not an eleemosynary institution. It's not going to say, oh, well, I'll just take lower profits. It will charge what the market will bear.
Well, Your Honor, I think Dish makes a point that this was not required as part of their service agreement. So to say that...
I think you've got your head in the sand. You've got to understand that if you win in this case and Social Security recipients can avoid paying their just debts, something will happen. Adjustments will be made. Prices will be higher. Payments will be collected in advance. That's usually what happens, by the way, in markets when you can't rely on people to pay later. You have them pay in advance. That's what a security deposit does for a renter and so on. Or they just won't deal. I think that's least likely. So payments will be higher or payments in advance. You can't ask us to just deny that one of those things will happen.
I think they can, as we put in our brief, they can make the contract that this is revocable. Let them know about it. And I don't know
what they're doing. Well, then it doesn't serve its purpose.
It doesn't serve the purpose. The termination fee is a means of paying for the gear if you don't pay through the monthly payments, right? Payment in advance would be the same thing as when you get the gear for Dish, you have to pay in cash for the gear right now.
And I think that the problem is that we're looking at the consequences as opposed to the two we have here, Ms. Tonsil, where they took almost a third of her monthly benefit to pay for TV service when they canceled the contract. She was not. She chose not to pay, and they took the money and canceled it.
Okay. Let me just ask you a slightly different problem that puzzles me, Mr. Keough, and that is, let's suppose you've got this fee of $225, and let's suppose that there's a bank account that has $300 in it. And if one had access to the information, you'd see that a couple of weeks ago there was a $200 gift to the plaintiff in that account. Can DirecTV or Dish Network collect?
I think we need to take a step backwards. There's two avenues to collect. They can sue her, and I think she would have to show
I'm talking about exercise the power that the contract gives them.
No, because the courts hold that commingling the funds, the exempt funds would still be exempt. The additional funds, the surplus, would not be exempt.
So they would have to know and work with the bank and closely scrutinize kind of the cash flow in and out of her account to make that determination? Is that just exactly how much they could extract?
No, Your Honor. I think the fact is that they have the choice to, if she's not paying, to attempt legal process. The idea is they can't.
So you would inflict upon them the choice between the expenses of a separate court action, and then you'd have the options that Judge Easterbrook has described. Because nobody's going to choose to do that.
Well, Your Honor, I think a built-in factor is every business has a certain slippage. They know a certain customer base is not going to pay and will not be recoverable. That's built into the price of product. So I don't understand why.
So they ought to just let it go?
When do you apply the money in account, to FIFO or LIFO?
So I see my time is up. Is there more questions?
No, as long as we're asking questions, you can answer.
FIFO or LIFO? Mm-hmm. First in, first out, or last in, first out?
Yeah, you know, I think when it's commingled, I think you look at the whatever's in excess of the actual fund. So I think the distinction between first in or first out doesn't matter. As far as
you owe a collector, you don't owe. I don't follow you.
Well, I think in short, the fact
you
is
just go wherever there's enough money to get it out.
Well, Your Honor, when we have someone whose sole benefit, monthly living expenses, is Social Security, and these funds are supposed to be protected, it seems, as the court in Tom held, that it seems odd to protect these people from
so
legal
we would
process.
Have. You're advocating a separate rule for people whose only income source is Social Security.
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
Okay. So then you have the problem that Judge Cudahy has asked you about.
Well, and I think it would be similar to the Treasury regulations, Your Honor, that were recently issued dealing with garnishment proceedings, that they have a set procedure for counting the excess money.
So this would apply to any merchants. They would have to have the access to the bank account records?
No, Your Honor. The Treasury regulations put the emphasis on the banks who are holding the money.
Right.
Because they, with computers, they instantly know how much is funded. And, of course, if the money is put in different accounts, there's no protection. Once the money is transferred out of the receiving account, there's no protection. And if Ms. Tonsil had other accounts, Dish would be able to attack those accounts. She did not, so they could not. So what we have here is a circumstance where they're precluded from going to a fair process adjudication of the money, instead relying upon self-help. And I understand that self-help is more convenient and faster, but it still should be afforded the same protections as the legal process portion of it. And we think for those
mm-hmm.
reasons.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Patch.
I think it's officially good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Richard Patch for Dish Network, LLC. Your Honors, Judge Guzman got this exactly right. He got it exactly right because the unprecedented interpretation that's being suggested by Tonsil, plaintiff here, to extend the language of 407 into, and I'm going to use the word, Social Security benign agnostic commercial transactions finds no precedent anywhere. It is contrary to the express language of Section 407. It defies common sense, and by the court's questions thus far, you recognize there's severe public policy issues involved if you end up restricting those kinds of transactions.
Of course, it wouldn't be the first federal statute that did more harm than good.
Well, Your Honor, if it did, but in fact it does not.
The law of unintended consequences is universal.
And particularly in litigation, Your Honor, but this statute does not intend these consequences because while it extends certain protections, and yes, it is to protect Social Security benefits from third-party creditors, it does so in two very specific ways. In fact, the parties start this case actually agreeing on something, as do most of the well-thought-out decisions, and certainly the decisions from this court recognize that 407 establishes two very particular restrictions. One is the right to receive payment cannot be assigned or transferred equitably or otherwise, and two, monies paid, that's the term, or monies payable cannot be levied upon, detached, et cetera, or seized by other legal process. And what we see, we start with that proposition, and then we hear the plaintiff say unequivocally, I'm not making any claim under the second prong. This is purely an assignment and transfer case. And then the very first thing he suggests to you is to depart from that distinction. And he turns to cases that uniformly are applying the anti-attachment provisions to suggest that somehow these funds in this circumstance are protected by the statute. And most importantly, he points the court to Philpott to say there, obviously, long time ago, the Supreme Court said monies that are paid into an account for the purposes of a state bringing a lawsuit and then executing on those funds were monies paid by the Social Security, and they retained that character. But monies paid is only in the second paragraph. The proper interpretation of the first prong are received payments. And assignment or transfer of received payments doesn't depend on the issue of whether they retain their character or not, because here the recipient received the full payments. The money went into their bank, and as this court held in Egan, as long held in Egan, once the monies are in the possession of the recipient, they are free to use them to pay pre-existing obligations. That's all that's happened here. Egan is controlling. Then Ms. Counsel suggests that perhaps Tidwell means something different. But in fact, as we've suggested to you, Tidwell supports our position, not the plaintiff's. Because in Tidwell, this court applied the very distinction that we think is critical. Namely, when this court said we're not going to follow the Moore line of decisions, you made that distinction on the basis that in Tidwell, and you say it at, I have the jump site if you need it, specifically the difference being is that in Tidwell the state received and cashed the funds. And in those cases, they did not. So that's the same basic rationale that applies in all of these cases where a representative payee authorized under the statute gets the funds, that's not an assignment or transfer. In Tidwell, it was one of the only assignment and transfer cases, and you held that because there was, in fact, an effective assignment, namely, the recipient lost the ability to control those funds, that was barred by 407. Now you come forward to Keffler. And Keffler, the Supreme Court, shifted ground slightly because it saw that under Philpott, courts were split. We had the Tom case, we have the Lopez case, we have the Mason case. So we have the 10th, 9th, and 2nd circuits going slightly differently, Tom specifically relying upon the fact that in Philpott they protected the funds against legal process following a civil suit by the state and said, in a relatively often quoted matter, and Tom, we see no reason why they would protect against that kind of formal levy and some informal set-off procedure. And that's what Tom said, and that's what allowed Tom to find that the set-off by banks against overdraft funds were actually a violation of the second prong. They were using, quote, other legal process. Now Treffler says no. And they specifically say at page 389 of Treffler, we didn't mean Philpott to say that. And we don't want you interpreting it that way. And so all of those lines of cases that were struggling with whether banks who had the free look in could exercise set-off rights and were trying, cases that were troubled by that, I think, said, we're going to consider that other legal process. Treffler says no, basically follows the Lopez line of thinking. And then we have five cases, all of which are cited in the brief since that time. Every single one of those cases is held on the principle that as long as the recipient continues to have control, and the language in the Fortunay case, I think, is the most clear to me when I read it, and that is all along the way the recipient had the, quote, unfettered ability not to deposit the money into the account and therefore could have prevented it from being exposed to any bank set-off claim or, in this case, an outstanding check or debit request. So the cases line up completely in our favor. The case here, remember, it's not a case of self-help. We have no right to say self-help. What we have is a debit authorization. All that debit authorization is like any other check or debit authorization. It's an instruction from the depositor to the bank that says, please pay this person upon presentation. And that's what happens. The bank, we go through a process. We don't have the ability to sweep in and take any funds. In the event you choose to reach the issue, we also believe it is extremely clear that there is no private cause of action here. First, the only basis for a private cause of action
is... I must say, this is about the third time today somebody has said something is clear. I don't find any case involving private rights of action extremely clear until the Supreme Court has decided that there is or is not a private cause of action. But as I understand the state of play, not a single court of appeals has decided whether there is a private right of action under this statute. Is that accurate?
That's absolutely accurate. No.
I don't think anything can be extremely clear when the current scorecard among appellate decisions is 0-0.
Well, with the one exception, and one that it suggests that it's not going to get there because every single district court, every single one that has addressed the problem says there is no cause of action. And we have three of those in separate parts of the country.
The Supreme Court once granted certiorari to resolve a conflict between all 11 regional U.S. courts of appeals and my friend and sometimes colleague Dan Fischel in an academic article, and it ruled in favor of Fischel. So even 11 to nothing among courts of appeals wouldn't make something clear.
Then let me put it, what I meant to say was that under the rules of court, as they've now been reaffirmed but in the Sapanauer case, those rules about whether we're going to imply a cause of action now have really come into focus and have left very little room. And when they're applied to the facts in this case, I believe leave little doubt, because all four now coalesce on some evidence with respect to congressional intent to create such a cause of action. And here, we don't have a single word. We scoured everywhere. There's not a word in the statute. There's not a word in the legislative history. There's not even a hint anywhere that Congress intended to create a private right of action here. And then you
of course,
take it,
earlier this morning, we were discussing implied rights of action under Rule 10b-5, all of which you just said accurately describes Rule 10b-5, and yet it's one of the best established implied rights of action around.
And that's perhaps because of the second reason it isn't needed here, and that's because it's not needed to effectuate the purpose of the statute. And here, first, they've created a right that doesn't exist in the statute,
to suggest that it has to be protected. We don't think that right exists. The two rights that do exist are simply no assignment and transfer. The commissioner...
Yes, I think we have your position, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.